First of all, let me just say, it's an honor and privilege to be here. It's the first time I've been to this parish, and I'm going to talk about a topic which has certainly gained a lot of notoriety in the last few decades on near-death experience, but we also want to talk about the resurrection of Jesus to, in many ways, clarify the distinctions, but also to talk about the relatedness of these experiences. Has anyone in this room gone through an experience like this? No one. Okay, usually I get somebody in the room. It's always good because then I can yank them up and they can take some of the time. We gave a program in 2006 to the deacons of the Archdiocese on near-death experience for a number of reasons. One, to help them to understand what people are going through. Second, how to talk to people and their families when they've gone through this. Also, how to talk to them in the context of faith about these experiences. If you look very deeply at the Catholic teaching on afterlife, there's not a lot of details. Do you ever notice that? It's really, we don't know what's going to look like and that type of thing, but you know, we believe in it, obviously. People who've gone through these experiences have something to say to us. And I think it's important for us to listen to what they have to say. I'm going to talk a little bit about what is typical of the experience, what are the different varieties of experience, what are the bases for accepting them as valid experiences, what are some of the challenges to it, and then how does it affect people's lives? One of the things that is important as human beings to recognize is that important events in people's lives have powerful effects on the direction of those lives. And we want to look at that as well as a piece of this. I've run into several people who've gone through this experience. One was my great-grandmother. One was one of my students when I was teaching high school. Some of the parishioners I've dealt with, some of the deacons, some priests, some sisters I've worked with, and so forth, dealing with this particular concern. And probably it's only in the last few decades that people have felt comfortable talking about this. You go on almost any talk show now, within that year, you'll have somebody on TV talking about it. The most recent celebrity is Dr. Eben Alexander. Alexander, I met out in Arizona this past summer. He was giving a talk on his experience as a neurosurgeon. Neurosurgeon, of course, their preoccupation is the human brain. And after he went through his own experience that was extremely life-altering and profound, he, as a neurosurgeon, tried to understand it in terms of modern science, and he basically said, I have no explanation for this in terms of science, what I know of the brain. This is not a brain phenomena. And more, the data keeps pointing in that direction, that we're not talking about delusions, generally speaking, or brain phenomenon, or drug-induced psychoses, and so forth. We're looking at something which is unexplainable in terms of modern science. So that's one of the things we want to begin with. I thought I would start off with a reading from St. Paul's second letter to the Corinthians. Paul kind of gets at... No, it's not. Paul gets at this. He talks about an experience that he either knew somebody who went through this or that it was actually he himself. Some people believe that actually Paul himself had gone through the experience and in a sense was relaying this as a way of simply talking about it. He said in chapter 12, he said, I must boast, but that is not profitable. But I would go on to visions and revelations of the Lord and know someone in Christ who 14 years ago, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, only God knows, was caught up to the third heaven. And I know that this person, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, was caught up to paradise and heard ineffable things which no one may utter. It's a passing reference, and then he goes on with the rest of they, but it's one of those things that strikes you. Paul was saying that he met somebody who went through an extraordinary experience where they could say some things, but they were not allowed. In other words, they couldn't bring back other things. And you run into this with people a lot who go through this experience. So I want to talk a little bit about what it is when we talk about near-death experience. A recent book came out by Sam Parnia, who's an MD who is now in New York. He's doing a what he calls part of the World Consciousness Project called AWARE. He spoke before the United Nations a couple years ago on the mystery of human consciousness. Scientists and others can say they are aware of consciousness. We all are. We just don't know how to explain it. Nobody knows where it comes from. Some people used to say, well, it's a product of the brain, but that doesn't work either, as we'll see. Nobody can figure out where it comes from. And so as Parnia got into this, he was, as a doctor, when his chief expertise is resuscitation. A doctor in that particular form of medicine is going to meet this experience on a number of occasions. People who have had, you know, massive cardiac arrest and have flatlined and who have suffered clinical death will sometimes tell doctors and nurses, I went through something extraordinary and I want to tell somebody. For a long time, doctors and nurses kind of blew it off and said, you know, this is hallucinations, or this is because of the drugs, or you were very, very sick, and things like that. But now it's becoming more and more difficult to simply dismiss it. I remember, it was about 15, 20 years ago, there was an article in the American Journal of Nursing, because my wife's a nurse, and occasionally I'll sneak a peek. And it was talking about this very phenomena, to take these people seriously, because we simply don't have an explanation as to why this is happening and what is happening to them. So little by little, the curtain's kind of being pulled back. In medical science, many doctors now take this seriously, and many of them now are leaders in the field of research in this very phenomena. One Pinvan Lambo wrote an interesting book, Consciousness Beyond Death. It's a fairly reasonable priced book. And he's done a very in-depth study of his cardiac patients. He's a world-famous cardiologist. And he's convinced that something is going on that science can't explain. His basic vision is that the mind and brain are not the same thing, that the mind uses the brain as kind of a transceiver. And that mind has an independent existence, which just has all kinds of implications, as you might imagine, for the way we see people and deal with them and so forth. The idea of near-death experience is not new, obviously. These experiences have been going on for centuries. In Plato's Republic, he talks about a soldier from Ur who was dead for a few days and came back to life to tell of an otherworldly journey. And somebody said, he was dead a few days? How is that possible? And that's the enigma. We don't know how normally that's possible. If you're dead, your brain obviously lacks oxygen. And your tissue should be destroyed by 3 days. That's it. You're done. Well, one case came up by the name. This guy's name is Jorge Rodonia. He is a physician. He's a Methodist minister now, too. Actually, he's a citizen of the Soviet Union, and he died. He was dead for 3 days. He was in the freezer, and rigor mortis had already set in, and they were going to do an autopsy on him, and they started cutting into him, and he woke up. Needless to say, the guy who was doing the cutting has been in therapy now for the last 20 years. And he had quite a story to tell as well. It changed his life. He was a member of the Communist Party and an atheist, and so he's no longer. Obviously, whatever the power of his experience was, it altered his perception of everything. And I'll talk more about some of the byproducts of the experience as well, which I think is very important to understand. If you meet anyone who's been through one of these experiences and they walk into your house and your computer goes on the fritz, it's probably them. Because something happens to their energy system in the body. And they can race all kinds of cane with appliances, and none of them can wear wristwatches because they drain the battery out within a day, so they don't work. All these little things, people have spontaneously gone into remissions. people have had lifelong chronic issues simply resolved after they've come back. There's so many things about this which defy traditional conventional explanations that it does bear and is beginning to gather the necessary attention to deal with this. My first encounter with this was when I was a student taking a philosophy class, and the professor had us read the book Life After Life by Raymond Moniz. Everyone pretty much familiar with that book. It was kind of the groundbreaking book that started this whole thing in 1975. He published this book as an MD. His mentor, George Ritchie, who was also a doctor, had had an experience when he was in the military. He was a medical doctor, and he suffered acute pneumonia and died clinically. No heartbeat, no brain wave, and so forth. And he went through this extraordinary experience, and he would talk to his prospective, these doctors, these young interns and so on, tell them what he went through, to explain to them that they may run into this as they become doctors and go through this type of thing with people. And it struck his fancy because he was also had a PhD in philosophy. So he decided to kind of investigate these things, and that's when the first book came out. When I read the book, I was incredulous. I was a young student that, you know, when you're young and you're in school, it has to be rational and reasonable, and you look at all this stuff and say, these people are obviously deluded. But as you begin to get into the material, you begin to say, well, maybe it's not that simple. There's something going on here. Some preliminary things we might say. NDEs, really, therefore, when we use the term near-death experience, we mean someone who's died clinically but has come back. So they're not gone. They've come back in some fashion. But according to they had flatlined, they had no brain function, and so forth. So for all intents and purposes, they were clinically dead. How is it they had experience when they were clinically dead is the question doctors are asking. Because the medical model is, if there's no oxygen going to the brain and blood has stopped flowing, there should be nothing going on. You should have no conscious experience, and that's something which has become a real difficult issue for them. Dr. Parnia refers to these as actual death experiences. In other words, people actually clinically died. So it's not, you know, near death seems to be kind of a fuzzy term, because people don't have to be near death to have profound experiences. There are mystical experiences as well that you don't need to die. They can happen at any time. So if you're in Stop and Shop one day and you see this phenomenal light and hear these voices, it's either you're having a tremendous experience or your kids have hit you over the head with something and have taken, okay. They do have similarities to mystical experiences, as we'll see, but there's a distinction about them. They're not proof. People like to use the word proof. Does this prove this? Does this prove that? The word proof, if we see it in terms of beyond a doubt, you're never going to get that in this life, right? I mean, there's just nothing you can absolutely prove. I think I was talking to some of the guys earlier, and I said, if someone said to me, I could say that you don't exist, even if people say, oh, yes, he does. Here, he's right there. No, he doesn't. You remember the guy Bert in Soap? Remember that thing long ago that Bert was convinced that he was invisible because no one ever talked to him? Okay. Proof, but we can say that the data points to something. Monica Helwig, who was a Catholic theologian who passed a few years ago, wrote a little something on this very phenomenon, and she said, I think the most we can say about this is it points to continuing consciousness after physical death. And that's the most we can say. That's a lot that we say. That's a big kind of statement to make. The other thing is, many people who study this are convinced these are not hallucinations. They just don't have the characteristics of hallucination. They are cogent, clear, very coherent types of experiences that people remember precisely even 50 years later. It's as though it was just happening to them at that moment. You know, many times with time, memory gets rather cloudy. But if you ask people to tell you their experience, almost right, that you will, the experience they had recorded 50 years ago will almost sound verbatim when they say it again. And they've done studies on this to see if people are embellishing or, you know, it's good time stories. Often people will embellish things. But that generally speaking, that is not the case, that people really stick to their story. What are the typical points of this? Some people would say that they went out of body. You'll hear that. I had an out-of-body experience. What they mean by that is they actually were out of their physical bodies looking at themselves from a vantage point, usually above. Many people will talk about relaying what went on in the room around them, what people were saying. Some people have been in other rooms. They go to another room and they hear what all their people, you know, their family was saying. They know what clothes they were wearing. They know what time it was on the clock. They know the instruments in the operating room, what they're saying. And they're able to tell doctors that, even though their eyes are taped shut and maybe even their ears have devices in them so that they could not hear. There's just no way to hear or see these types of things. Those are called veridical experiences. That is, experiences that can be verified by an objective observer about what was going on in the room around them. Sometimes these can prove rather embarrassing too, because they'll hear people say things, and you know, or the doctor made a mistake. And one guy said, "You know, doc, you made a mistake when you did that." And of course, the doctor didn't want to admit to the fact, but in fact, he had, and everyone in the room knew it. These are the kinds of things that send a shiver through people in their, you know, in the operating room. If you talk to people who are in critical care, a number of them will say, "We've seen things we can't explain." You know, and that's something that's typical. Before I go any further, I thought we'd do is just see a sample experience of a gentleman who went through this. His name is Gordon Allen. He was a very wealthy financier on the West Coast, and something radically changed his experience. So all you have to do is just hit play, and we'll be ready to go. Let me just get out of the way for you. It's about 10 minutes or so.
For decades after the experience, they typically become...
Dr. Bruce Grayson is down at the University of Virginia. He was here at UConn for years.
Prestige, fame, much more altruistic, much more concerned with relationships and with the spiritual side of lives. And we have many examples of people who've changed their careers, who changed relationships as a result of their near-death experience.
And very successful financier who worked in the heart of the Pacific Northwestern business world.
Important values that I had at that time, the first important value was to make sure that everything was okay with my children. The second important value was to maintain cash flow, and that was really what made me run. It also was a lot of fun to make money. I enjoyed making money. The funny thing about money, and the good news about money in some respects, is that it totally doesn't care who owns it or how your kids own it. It really doesn't matter. And so that means that one person who's a not very good person can have a lot, and somebody who's a good person may be really going to have it, because money doesn't discriminate in any sense of the term.
Gordon's ruthless business world was about to be turned upside down. He became acutely ill with pneumonia. Feeling like he was about to die, he took himself to hospital.
I remember putting me in a wheelchair. I remember looking at the admitting area and being wheeled into some sort of a room. That's about what I remember of that part of it. My next cognitive memory is that of leaving and traveling, you know, and the out-of-body experience begins. first thing that came over me was this absolutely profound sensation of love. I mean, it was so unconditional, a love of the child, of the child, of the mother, of the two of those interacting. And that love was so totally unconditional, it was overwhelming to me. And that was beautiful and wonderfully accepting. And as I proceeded into this, the sense of this very profound love was followed by a sense of purposefulness, that whatever is happening has a point to it. I ended up in more of a space. I'm not standing on grass, and I'm not out into the woods, and there aren't streets paved with gold, but where I'm at is in a space. And a high spiritual being has greeted me, and there's two other spiritual beings, one on the left, one on the right, and I'm being communicated with. There's no, I cannot recreate the sounds in my mind, but I was greeted as an old friend and a loved brother, and that if I chose to come home, I could. Yet, I had not finished what I was there to do, and they said, look, they didn't say look. And immediately the thoughts communicated to me that all the skills and all the talents and everything that I've been given, which I've been very, very, very blessed with, were for a purpose greater than the purpose that I used it for. The purpose of making money in it itself wasn't it, but there was another purpose for it, and that they should now be applied in some ways that would be shown to me. Absolutely, that's the moment my life changed. That is the moment my life changed. When I came back, my heart is filled, and you would describe this as being on fire. Your heart feels like your heart's on fire. And it's on fire with love, okay? The sensation of love that I experienced as I was going through the out-of-body experience has retained itself. I'm there, it's in me. It hasn't gone away, it hasn't changed. So I'm trying to understand where it's going to go, but I've decided that I was not going to try to save anything that I had from my past life in the financial world or the business or anything. So those people were most vehement about the fact that I wasn't going to work in the real world anymore as a financial guru, and that they weren't going to be able to make a lot of money off of me anymore by whatever method that was. I called them up. I say, hi Bill, hi Jack, or whoever it was. This is Gordy, you remember? Oh yeah, Gordy. And you could hear him pull back off the phone because they're waiting for the hit. Because in the old days that might have been a hit coming after him, looking for money or whatever I was doing. I said, hey, you know, last time we talked, I wasn't really too happy about the way that came out. And I think I would be less than candid if I didn't say I was not being good to you. That I wasn't being loving to you. And I just wanted to call you and ask your forgiveness for whatever I might have done to you. If you want to hear dead air on a telephone, do that. You have total silence. And then there's a little stutter, and I say, well, yeah, I guess so, or whatever, and that's the end of it.
Today, Gordon has severed all links with business and left the world of money far behind. He's now a qualified counselor, and uses his new understanding to help others change their lives.
The after effects that Gordon Allen experienced are typical of a large number of near-death experiencers whose lives before the experience were not compatible with the values they learned afterwards. Some of the people that I've talked with, including like a policeman who found he couldn't kill people, couldn't shoot after his experience, and went on to become a high school teacher.
I got that from this interesting film called The Day I Die, The Mind, the Brain, and Near-Death Experience from the BBC. It's the best one out so far that deals with this in a number of different ways. Very well put together. But you can see that one of the striking things about this experience is that it changes people for the better. There are some people who have a hard time negotiating the changes, as we'll talk a little bit about. But I do want to get into basically the overall
organized crime. went down to become.
I want to talk about the overall characteristics of it. You just put it on pause. That's great. Okay, well, that's right. I'll just continue. And first of all, for many, there's this sense of the ineffable. They can't describe necessarily in human words what it was like. So they use metaphor a lot, which is typical profound religious experience. The great mystics often used metaphors because human language simply cannot serve the purpose of adequately nailing this down. There's a great feeling of peace for many. It's as though, okay, you're safe, it's all right. And many of them, of course, what's typical of that is they don't want to leave that. They like that. Many will hear unusual noises or a humming. Some see a tunnel, but not in all cases. But there is usually something that seems to suggest a transition of some kind. They will often meet people, spiritual beings, some will talk about, some will identify it as Jesus. Some will talk about seeing deceased relatives or deceased friends. Many people talk about a bright light, as we saw here, as exuding this sort of unconditional loving to people. Many will experience what they call a panoramic life review, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. They see their whole lives before them in like a hologram. And it's as though they actually see every moment of their lives. Now, one of the things that's characteristic of this experience is time changes. The way we experience time and the way they experience time in those situations is totally different. Everything has happened, in a sense, simultaneously. So they don't know if they were gone for 5 minutes or 5 hours. Everything just seems to be different, but they remember every thought they ever had and everything they did, how it impacted on others, how it impacted on themselves. I got to admit, when I first ran into this, it was a little off-putting. I'm not sure I want to remember everything I did or see everything I thought. Many of them will have an experience where they come to like a border, that if they cross this border, they can't go back. That's often part of the experience. A frustration at trying to tell other people what they went through. I've often sat with people and they'll keep saying it was like this, or you know, it was like, and they just get kind of flustered because they can't quite get the words the way they'd like to. A deepening of their spiritual lives, for sure. Some who are part of, well, say, an organized church experience will remain in that experience but deepen it. So often, participation in our own religious traditions for many has different strata of involvement, as you know. Some are deeply immersed not only in church life, but in the spiritual aspects, the depth of that spiritual experience. Others are kind of remote. Maybe they go from time to time. But whatever wherever they are, after this experience, something shifts. A depth of their spiritual life is certainly point, and they seek out more knowledge and understanding of their experience. Almost to a person I've spoke to is an elimination of the fear of death. You know, people often say to me, I don't care about dying. I just, I'd like it to be quick and painless, but it doesn't frighten me anymore. And I'd say for many people that would be a great burden off their shoulders to simply be able to live with a certain sense of freedom that so many of these people seem to experience. For them, they've come to the understanding that the most important thing in life is loving one another. We know that deep down, but it's so hard to get us to keep doing it. I mean, as human beings, we operate on so many different levels. And we know really the truth of this, but for these folks, it's no longer open for discussion. Simply the way it is. So there are some distressing experiences that people have. Many of them seem to be rather pleasant, but some have some distressing experiences that I'll get into in a little bit. They also sense that there's a meaning to the whole thing about our lives, that there's nothing that happens by accident. That is their, I mean, almost to a person I've spoken to on this, Oh yeah, everything fits like a huge jigsaw puzzle. We just don't see it. You know, there are no coincidences. That's the way they see it, that there is something bigger going on, even though we don't understand where it fits in our lives. You know, it's like, you know, that day when you come home and the water heater's broken and it's snowing like crazy outside and you try to start the snowblower and that breaks down. And you know, this is all for a reason? What, to frustrate me, to get me agita, or what? So that's part of it. One of the things about the life review, the panoramic life review, I think we need to talk a little bit about is the impact that has on their lives. You not only see your life, but they tell me, and report a lot, that they experience the emotional content of everything. Not simply their emotions, but the emotions of the other people they did things to. So, if you were loving toward another, you get to feel the satisfaction that comes from that kind of experience. If you were cruel, you get to experience that experience from that person's point of view. So it's a complete empathetic kind of experience. It's meant to educate. To a person, they said, I was meant to learn something in all this. That what you do to others, you do to yourself. So when Jesus said, do unto others as they would have you do unto you, or what we call sort of the golden rule through every culture, you're really, the reason why you're going to do that is because you're doing it to yourself. That's basically, that's the spiritual truth of things, that we don't, there's no free lunch in a sense, that the choices we're making to be loving or to be hurtful to another has a bounce back on us. So that's something important. Here's one lady named Minette talks about her experience. She said, no matter what I did to any person, what that action might be, good or bad, that action would react not only upon me, but on others around me. I knew that every action had its own reaction. What we do for or against another, we do to ourselves. I fully understand what Jesus meant when he said, as you did it to the least of these, you've done it to me. Another one named Peggy said, I was shown how much people are loved. It was overwhelmingly evident that the light loved everyone equally without conditions. The light was extremely concerned and loving toward all. I can remember looking at the people together and the light asking me to love these people. I thought if only they could know how much they were loved, maybe they wouldn't feel so scared or lonely anymore. And another man named, believe it or not, Tom Sawyer, says, in one scene in my life, I had felt rage, the indignation and the embarrassment, the frustration, the physical pain of the person I had beat up. I felt my teeth going through my lower lip. In other words, I was in that man's situation. I was in his body. I experienced everything of that interrelationship between that man and me as very personal, confidential, and private in nature. An extraordinary experience. Another part of this, another category of experience is not just to an individual, but sometimes groups of people experience what we'd consider a near-death experience. Say, for instance, someone's in a room and they're actively dying. Sometimes whole families have been able to experience these life reviews with that individual. Let me just read one. This experience comes out of a book called Glimpses of Eternity by Raymond Moody. So the day my mother died, my two brothers, my sister-in-law, and I were all in the room. My mother hadn't spoken a word in several hours, and she was breathing in an irregular pattern. None of us were really upset because mother had been on a long downhill course, and we knew that this was the end. Suddenly, a bright light appeared in the room. My first thought was that a reflection was shining through the window from a vehicle passing by outside. Even as I thought that, however, I knew it wasn't true because this was not any kind of light on this earth. I nudged my sister to see if she saw it too, and when I looked at her, her eyes were as big as saucers. At the same time, I saw my brother literally gasp. Everyone saw it together, and for a little while, we were frightened. Then my mother just expired, and we all breathed a sigh of relief. At that moment, we saw a vivid bright lights that seemed to gather around and shape up into, I don't know what you would call it, except an entranceway. The lights looked a bit like clouds, but that's only a comparison. We saw Mother lift out of her body and go through the entranceway. Being by the entranceway was a complete feeling of joy. My brother called it a chorus of joyful feelings. My sister heard beautiful music, although none of the rest of us did. I'm originally from Virginia. My sister, brothers, and I said that it felt that the entranceway was shaped like the natural bridge of the Shenandoah Valley. The lights were so vivid we had no choice but to tell our story to the hospital nurse. She listened and then told us she knew of similar things happening and that it was not uncommon for the dying process to encompass people nearby. These are some of the things that you run into in the field, and certainly things I've run into. I remember a parishioner coming out after Mass one time. He was a lovely man. He really was a salt of the earth kind of guy. You know, what you saw was what you got. And he came to me and said, you know, 3 weeks ago, I died, and I saw this light, and I think it was God. And so we started talking. So I just simply told him, I said, you know, Joe, you're one of about 15 million Americans who say something similar. And he was very relieved by that, because so often people don't know what to make of their experience and whether or not you'll think they're crazy. So we had a discussion, and he said, I was talking with this, and I said, you know, in this conversation with God, did my name come up at all? I want to know where I stand. There are four basic types of experience that seem to be typical of this. One we will call an initial experience. That involves elements like people entering this sort of loving, what they call even nothingness. It's like a darkness, but it's not a frightful darkness. It's a comforting type of thing. There's a friendly voice or the sense of being out of body. Such experiences may be, in a sense, seeds that help people see through some difficult times in life often, or gives them clarity about something. There's unpleasant experience, or what some people would say they'd be like hellish, where they experience things like a void or some kind of like demon-like creatures. Often enough, though, that if these people utter some kind of prayer, they seem to dissipate and they go into what would be typical of a more pleasant kind of experience. And no one really knows how to understand these particular things, because these are of a nature which, again, are normal, conventional ideas that simply seem to work. Some have what they call pleasant or heaven-like. Many people experience heaven-like scenarios of loving family reunions with those who have died previously. Now, some people will say, oh, well, of course they do. But some of the challenges here are that many times people will meet someone they don't know. And then they come back and someone will find out that, for instance, this is one guy who went to his mother and said, I met this person who seemed to know, I didn't know who this guy was. And eventually the conversation moved toward he was not really the son of the father he lived with, but of another man she had had a relationship with. And she showed him the picture and he almost fell over. That's exactly the person he met. And you get these kind of experiences over and over again. Even young children have these experiences in utero. One child was born and said to the mother one day when she was able to talk, why did you try to kill me when I was in your tummy? These are the kinds of things that constantly defy what we would call, say, a normal kind of explanation. We don't have a way of giving account of these types of things. Or Dr. Alexander, if you haven't heard him on talk shows, when he went through his experience, there was this young, beautiful woman on a butterfly wing that was taking him through his experience. And he didn't know who this was. He had expected to see his dead father. His father was a famous neuroscientist, neurosurgeon, and he expected of anybody, I'd see somebody like my father in this, but he didn't. And evidently, this widow took him through it, and after he got done with this experience, and he was in recovery and so forth, he tried to make contact with his birth parents. He had been given up for adoption many, many years when he was a young baby. And he had tried to get in touch with them. Finally, he got in touch with them. He met with them. And they were talking about a daughter they had that had already died. And he never knew who she was. He never met his family prior to this. And they showed her a picture of her, and he almost fell off the chair. That was the one who was on the butterfly wing with him when she was going through this experience. And you see this kind of thing repeated over and over and over again with these types of experiences. So let me just go through some of the, why don't we go for about 10 more minutes, then we'll break for a few minutes and then regather, okay? Just to give you a sense of this. Psychologically, there's a loss of the fear of death, almost to a person. You just don't get that charge anymore from people. They're kind of blasé about dying. Some people actually look forward to it because they want to go back to where they were. They become more spiritually, although some of them may leave organized religion if the experience they were having was not squaring with the experience they had in the near-death encounter. Other people who've come from a community which is largely loving, people-centered, and so tend to just stay in there. Children who don't even have religious upbringing who go through these experiences will often build an altar in their room and want to go to church. They will drag their parents. I want to go to God's house. You see? And kids who, those are kids who didn't really, some of them never even heard of any of this, but they have tremendous experiences where now they're, in a sense, pulling their parents there. That's really wild. These people tend to be able to abstract very easily. Their thought processes actually accelerate. Rather than brain damage, the brain and the mind are operating at a hyper level of capacity. So that people who, for instance, this one guy who was a mechanic, began to be fascinated by quantum mechanics, you know, physics. And he started reading, and he knew what the math was, and he never studied math. And so, you know, you look at this kind of thing, and obviously something's happening. People tend to now be more philosophical. The things that they thought were important really don't matter much anymore. The things they thought were trite become essential. Bouts of depression can occur with these folks. It takes between about 7 to 10 years for a person to integrate this experience into their life if they have help with people. I mean, their families are often affected very deeply by these because you now have a changed human being. You know, your spouse who may have been an A personality, who had everything structured and was a driver, you know, really driven, now becomes a classic B personality who wants to sniff the roses all day. And they don't want to pay the bills. And time functions differently now for them. They're not stuck on the wristwatch. They kind of get to it when they're going to get to it. It is interesting. Some studies have been done that when married, people who are part of a marriage have these experiences, somewhere between 70 and 75% of those marriages dissolve because of the experience. Because if that person in the family haven't been counseled on how to deal with this, it can create tremendous havoc, you know, with the family. Look what happened with Gordon Allen. This guy's flying high and he gave all that up. He's living in a couple rooms now being a counselor. That takes a tremendous toll on the family in the way you have been living your life. They tend to be more generous people, more charitable by nature. A concern for social justice is important because human beings are important. Relationships take precedent over everything now for these people. They tend to be less competitive. They have a heightened, they call it sense, sort of all the senses work as one. Smell, taste, touch, they call it synesthesia. They're, you know, sometimes they actually feel red, you know, or they smell blue, that type of thing. It's an extraordinary phenomenon. Increased psychic abilities. Many of our great mystics over the centuries have acquired these abilities, not because they sought them, because it was a byproduct of their deep prayer life. But some people will have these, and for some it's very troublesome because they don't know what to do with them. There's like a childlike wonder now with the world again. They tend to be less stressed. In fact, their blood pressure tends to go down. So if you're having blood pressure problems, go have a near-death experience. Your blood pressure will probably go down. More detached and objective about the world. and a hunger for knowledge. They want to know everything they possibly can, because that was part of the experience. Many of them will talk about, I knew everything for a time. Everything that was ever to be known, I knew. But I couldn't take it back with me. That's one of the provisos when you come. You can't bring that back. But it says, they will simply start reading and delving into things they never thought was part of. Physiologically, heightened intelligence. Children who go through this are often, their IQs are extraordinary. The problem for children like that, of course, as you might imagine, is peerage. How do you work with your peers? These kids tend to be more mature, clever. They are in a place spiritually that dwarf adults many times. One child had the capacity to like read people's thoughts. I don't know if actually words, but knew if a person was being honest or was giving them the runaround. And I talked to this individual. He said, it's been a burden. You know, I talked to a woman who could go through this. And the first thing, when she told me that, I started thinking, what a beautiful woman this is. I figured she could read my thoughts. That's the ones I want her to be reading. Some of them may have less energy. Some may have increased energy. It all depends on who they are. Accelerated metabolism, a sensitivity to drugs and other pharmacological substances. Very sensitive, some to light and sound, because their sensory capacities are very acute, many of them. Tend to get away from meat and eat more vegetables. They look physically younger. If you see before and after pictures, you're struck by the fact this person looks 20 years younger. If you look in their eyes, the eyes almost glow. And not like, you know, you turn off the light and they're green, but they have a gleam in their eye, which is unmistakable. Some of the experiences emotionally for these people, some are ecstatic and feel blessed by the experience and want to tell everybody. Some feel grateful that it happened to them. Some are evangelizing about it. And others are humbled by the magnitude of what's happened to them. For other people, they're angry. Angry for being brought back. There will be people who are in the hospital when you use the paddles on them and they come back are furious. I met one priest who went through this in this archdiocese. He was absolutely furious. He said, he's had four heart attacks since. He said, I was fine before. Why'd you bring me back? Guilt. Many times for not missing loved ones. Many of them say, look, I'm just going to stay here. This is good. I like this. Oh, no, you can't. Your time is, no, I'm staying. No, you're not. You're going back. Disappointment for being back in this very painful body for some of them. I mean, they were free. They could go anywhere they wanted by just thinking about it. Anything they wanted, just by thinking about it, things would happen. Now they're back in this body where the reason why they went out of body to begin with is they're in pain and they're suffering. And now they've got to go through all these... I met one woman, she died on I-95. She was in a terrible auto accident. And she was pronounced dead four times. She came back each time, they resuscitated her. She had wonderful stories to tell. But she's had 16 operations since then to try to get back to a normal life. So, you know, she's grateful for the experience, she's grateful to be back, but it's been awful hard for her. Depression is not unusual because they don't know where they fit anymore in the world. They can't come here and be like they were, and they're not sure how they fit in with the rest of everybody. It is hard to watch sometimes. The man he was talking about, the police officer who, I know who he was. He lives in Connecticut. I know his brother. And we talked about this, and he said he could not even look at a gun. He couldn't watch a football game for 2 years. He couldn't watch a boxing match. He said he eventually went into teaching and counseling. And he said after a number of years, he said he's getting a little bit better. He can watch a football game now. So he's coming back more into this realm again from what he was over there. But it is of a nature which goes down to your core. That's all I wanted, that this particular experience rattles people in the sense that they are not going to be the person you knew prior to the experience. Or the person you knew, they're going to go up to the ninth level. Let's say if they were a loving and kind person to begin with, more than likely, you're just going to see a greater manifestation of that. It's hardest on those emotionally who were the complete opposite of what they experienced. You know, if they were a crass, cruel individual, it's going to shatter that old self, and the new self now has to be reconstructed. It was one guy who was a hitman for the mafia. He went through his experience. Needless to say, he's not doing contracts anymore. He is now working with homeless youth, trying to get them a fair shake and dealing with kids who are in trouble, trying to help them to kind of straighten their lives out. All right, we've kind of covered some of the basics of this. I thought what I would do is just go over, when we come back, some of the possible explanations. Then we're going to talk a little bit about, obviously, the resurrection of Jesus and kind of look at the two things here as to maybe what's going on with all this and what possible things can we draw from this. Okay, why don't we take about, 10 minutes or so? And there's still stuff to eat back there. It's a little cold, but that's fine.
Back there.